Continuing the audio summary of the book Crisis of Character by Gary J. Byrne, we continue with Chapter 8. This chapter involves scenes of operations in the White House under President Clinton. When Clinton first arrived, his chief of staff was a longtime pal from the days in Arkansas, Mac McClarty. Under McClarty, staffers were unprofessional, sloppy, disrespectful, and spilled so much soda and coffee in the West Wing that the General Service Administration gave up trying to clean the carpets and simply replaced them. Clinton replaced McClarty with Leon Panetta in July 1994, and things got more professional fast. Gary relates a meeting in one of the White House rooms where the president stopped by. Panetta was the only person in the room who stood up when the president entered. One guy kept his feet propped up on a desk. Afterwards, Panetta let his staffers know that was unacceptable, period, regardless of the staffer's previous experience and ties to the president. However, while unethical behaviors have existed in previous administrations, amongst the staffers under the Clintons, in Gary's opinion, they accelerated. He feels it starts at the top. An example given is that Jennifer Flowers stated publicly that she had been Clinton's mistress for 12 years. Other women came forward with allegations which were all denied by the Clintons and their staff. Attempted to impugn the credibility of the accusers and perhaps even pay some of them off or intimidate them into being quiet. The Whitewater scandal was a distraction. The Clintons were not charged, but were deeply involved. An example of Clinton's casual attitude about security involved, of all things, jogging. He wouldn't tell the Secret Service personnel whether he was going jogging or wasn't going jogging, or when. He would just appear at an entrance either dressed for jogging or dressed for the office. The Secret Service personnel assigned to protect him either had to quickly get into running gear while trying to conceal weapons, or stay in suits. The president also chose the route, seemingly at random. On one of these jogging excursions, there was a nearly successful assassination attempt. Very difficult for the Secret Service personnel to maintain security without the cooperation of the First Family. He talks about a time a pilot purposely brought a light plane onto the White House grounds and died during the crash landing. Another time a guy sprayed bullets toward a tour group and a person that he thought was the president from the fence. He was tackled by three civilians and arrested. Gary was impressed with Clinton's personality, how he always stayed cool, always was in good spirits, and he says that Clinton had real magnetism that one could feel. He talks generally about various sexual indiscretions some of the Secret Service agents and execs would get into, and he feels that behavior like that starts at the top, that it's hard to maintain discipline when people at the top are literally screwing around. Chapter 9. This chapter didn't have much really about the First Family worth relating. Pretty interesting scenes of various things that happened in the White House. I recommend getting the book if you want to find out more about some of the inside stuff that goes on in the White House. Chapter 10. During the November 1995 federal budget shutdown of the government meant a lot less traffic at the White House. Gary said this was, oddly, hard on the president because he felt Clinton had no real support group, that his wife was not supportive of him unless the cameras were rolling. He discusses the intern, Monica Lewinsky, and how she constantly maneuvered to reach her target, the president, and how he was quite willing to take her in. Soon she was having private meetings with the president. Other women soon appeared with similar intentions. Secret Service agents and uniformed division personnel would occasionally, inadvertently, discover the president and Monica in various non-professional situations, which put everyone in a very difficult and awkward situation. Repeatedly. If nothing else, Gary felt this was difficult to believe, that the president, with so many enemies, and with Ken Starr investigating Whitewater for all he was worth, Why would he take such risks over and over? The personal protection details for Hillary and for the president would communicate with each other so that the group responsible for Hillary would know when the president was with someone privately and shouldn't be disturbed. On one occasion, on a weekend, Monica appeared and was chased away by Gary. Shortly thereafter, the president popped out of the Oval Office and asked if anyone had come by for him. Then Gary saw Monica peeping out from the nearby Roosevelt Room. It was apparent to Gary that the president had given Monica the number to his direct phone line, which is not simply a normal phone number, but requires a special code keyed in a certain way. At one point, Gary was urged by other Secret Service officers to do something about Monica and her private meetings with the president. Gary went to Deputy Chief of Staff Evelyn Lieberman and asked her to fire or transfer Monica out of the West Wing of the White House without saying exactly why, only that it was important to the administration. The next day, Monica was transferred to the East Executive Office Building, working under the First Lady. Gary said that the first couple had really loud arguments when alone, and that Hillary would chew anyone out, no matter what kind of personal staff or White House resident staff or Secret Service personnel, including Gary. Gary wondered what she would do if she happened to walk in on the president with a mistress. Should he prevent her from entering? Should he try to separate them if it got physically threatening to the president? Chapter 11. Monica got her blue pass, which identified her as a paid staff member, authorized to be in the White House. Gary looked at this as a situation where the president got her a job, paying his mistress with government money, and giving her some kind of a security clearance to be okay in the White House. Gary worried that if Hillary found her husband alone with Monica, that it would result in Gary being out of a job. Once Gary was working an evening shift during the Christmas season and was outside the map room. A steward opened the door to enter the map room, and they could see the president making out on a table with E! Network host Eleanor Mondale, former Vice President Walter Mondale's daughter. Gary discussed with a personal protection detail agent how things went when the president was on the road and still made time to see mistresses, plural. Once a Navy steward who had worked for many presidential administrations came to Gary, distraught. He showed Gary a towel stained with semen and lipstick. He said he had been cleaning such towels by hand for weeks, afraid to give them to other Navy laundry personnel to clean for fear it would result in a scandal, embarrassing the presidency. Gary concluded that the lipstick belonged not to Monica, which was his first thought, but to a receptionist. He never told anyone who he suspected, not even the steward. Gary got the steward to bring him the rest of the towels he had, and Gary secreted them out of the White House and disposed of them. No details given on that. He worried that he was destroying evidence, but figured since there was no investigation into the president's sexual affairs, only the Whitewater case, that was justified. He was protecting the president. But what a lousy situation to be placed in by a man who clearly didn't care. Chapter 12. Gary felt that Hillary disliked the uniform division intensely and felt that she wanted to get rid of it. He felt changes they mandated beginning in 1993 worsened relations between the Secret Service agents and the uniformed officers. He tells of an incident when he saw a lieutenant change an evaluation score for two black officers and spoke up about it, and gives this as an example of how it wasn't just the Clinton administration which had problems, it was also the Secret Service. Gary studied hard to learn the history of every part of the White House so that he could get a promotion to work in the tours detail, which gave tours of the White House, and to get away from the Oval Office. Then Gary got word that the Oval Office logbook had been subpoenaed by investigator Ken Starr. That got him worrying that he would be drawn into things, and worrying about late-night meetings the president had had many times with Hillary and a political pollster named Dick Morris. These meetings essentially left Clinton's official chief of staff, Leon Panetta, out of the loop. He also worried about the many mistresses Clinton had going, both in D.C. and on the road. On December 6, 1997, Monica was at the Northwest Gate and was told to wait. The officer on duty knew that the president had another mistress in his office, and so did the president's secretary. Monica pressed the issue, and the agent told her that the president was meeting with another piece of ass, and she would have to wait. This marked the first time, as the summarizer understood that Gary was trying to say, that a uniformed division officer had let one mistress, Monica, know that the president had another mistress. Before that, they and the other White House staff had managed to keep them all separate. Gary transferred out of the White House to a Secret Service training facility northeast of D.C., possibly with his transfer expedited by the president, since he was an impediment to the president's affairs with Monica and others. Gary heard on the Howard Stern radio show how the Drudge Report had reported on the president's lying and cheating, especially about the president lying on a sworn affidavit, and how it involved the Secret Service. Gary threw up. He knew he was probably the only person who could prove the president had lied under oath, and that would open the president up to being impeached. The president had signed an affidavit saying he had had no sexual relations with Paula Jones, and had never even been alone with Monica Lewinsky in the same room, and that others could corroborate that statement. Up to this time, the Clintons had denied any involvement or wrongdoing in the other scandals, such as Whitewater, Vince Foster's suicide, Travelgate, Filegate, affairs with women, bribes, Troopergate, etc. But this time, Clinton denied it on a sworn affidavit. Chapter 14. Gary got his first subpoena from the Justice Department, and some more. The legal department of the Secret Service stalled, but things kept moving toward having to do something about it. He was called in for a meeting with the legal folks at the Secret Service. It became clear, I don't know if I mentioned it, but this is chapter 14, it became clear that they were representing the service, not Gary, and there were none of the confidentiality privileges enjoyed in the normal attorney-client relationship. He was informed at length of what information was confidential and couldn't be revealed under any circumstances. He was told he couldn't perjure himself or withhold information he knew from being employed in the Secret Service, but he couldn't reveal secret information. It was a tough situation to be in. Plus, the lawyers didn't have the same security clearance as Gary did, so he couldn't tell them some things, and that complicated matters. Going over all of that took a week. Pretty bewildering for Gary, who had long ago been diagnosed with ADD and dyslexia, not good with written material, a lot of legal mumbo-jumbo. A story appeared in the news that said Prosecutor Starr wanted information from Secret Service agent Gary Byrne about a meeting Gary had had with Deputy Chief of Staff Evelyn Lieberman that took place a day before Monica was dismissed. Lieberman said she didn't recall any details per the story. Comment from the summarizer CleanGov is, that didn't help. It meant it would be everyone else's word against Gary's. End of comment. Continuing with the summary, Gary called an attorney friend who had worked for the CIA and for a senator's office. He was willing to give legal advice and counsel pro bono, meaning at no charge to Gary. If the government ever paid people involved for their legal fees, they would ask for money then from the government. That was a big deal because Gary knew of colleagues who had to pay for their own legal advice at $350 an hour or more. This heavy financial burden made it much easier for so many folks in a similar situation to simply say, "I don't recall," which was what the Clintons counted on, knowing that people who could reveal their secrets couldn't afford to enter into a long, drawn-out legal contest, and knowing such people would also be afraid of demotions or transfers or dismissals, which Gary felt was pretty callous on the Clintons' part, inflicting those kinds of situations on people who were sworn to protect them. Gary's legal guys called the legal guy who had been appointed by Attorney General Janet Reno, who was also a Clinton appointee, to represent the Secret Service in a tussle with Ken Starr, and asked him if he had any issue with an unnamed Secret Service agent hiring his firm as his own independent counsel, and the guy said he had no issue with it at all, which was good. Linda Tripp, who Monica had met at the Pentagon, met with Monica at a hotel, and Monica gave Tripp a document of unknown origin detailing what one should say on an affidavit to protect Clinton from charges of sexual harassment from another woman, another volunteer at the White House. Tripp passed that information on to Newsweek and to Ken Starr, which gave Starr enough ammunition to get approval from Janet Reno to expand the investigation from Whitewater, where the main witness, Jim McCoop McDougal, had mysteriously died, to include conspiracy and perjury in Paula Jones' sexual harassment case. Tripp had also recorded her conversations with Monica, during which Monica told her about giving oral sex to Clinton during times he was on the phone with ambassadors and with Dick Morris. Monica, of course, didn't have clearance to listen in on conversations like that, and was herself a person who could have been rather easily forced to divulge confidential information to third parties, including foreign agents. And the president was paying for this oral sex with taxpayers' monies. Somewhere along the line, Tripp got Monica to give her the blue dress, which had been ejaculated upon by Clinton. The dress was proof that the president was lying about never having an affair with Monica, and indeed, never even being alone with her in the same room. So, from Gary's viewpoint, which the summarizer feels is valid, Clinton had a history of sex and near sexual relations with a long string of women, many of them employees or volunteers, and some even alleged that he assaulted them. It revealed that Clinton had no sense of ethics in this area and actually felt he was above the law and was willing to perjure himself and get others to perjure themselves to protect his public persona. This moral corruption spreads downward from the top to other areas of the White House and to the government as a whole and to the Secret Service. Gary felt that if the Secret Service agents and uniformed division officers were risking their lives for a person of integrity, that was totally fine. Comment from the summarizer is, not so much for a person like Clinton. End of comment. Gary feels that the successes the Clintons enjoyed were due to the people of character around them, and their scandals and failures were directly traceable back to their own lack of morals and sense of what is right and what is wrong. For days, Gary was grilled by men in expensive suits in Ken Starr's investigation office, and it was adversarial from the beginning, with Gary saying what he felt didn't violate security, and the FBI people certain Gary was hiding pertinent facts. The strain began to wear him down, and he thought at one point that he knew how David Foster must have felt before he supposedly committed suicide. Not that Gary ever contemplated that solution, but it was tough. At one point, an FBI agent yelled at him that he would come to Gary's house and arrest him in front of his pregnant wife. They almost got into a physical fight then and there. The Secret Service attorney came in and ushered Gary out and then tore into the Star people and the FBI, saying that they were way out of line. Gary got fairly paranoid at this time, wondering if they were actually behind the many suspicious deaths of people involved in their activities. He kept hearing the words of many Arkansas troopers and the personal protection detail officers who all used the word ruthless in discussing the Clintons, and phrases like, quote, "everything you hear about them is true," unquote. He prepared a place to go to at a friend's place in the country with his wife if things got out of hand and they had to make a run for it. He figures the blue dress that Monica had worn one day to a meeting with Clinton, and which he had soiled, saved his life. Tripp had gotten it from Monica. Tripp turned it over to the FBI, and the FBI then pressured Monica to testify against Clinton in return for immunity. Gary took off with his wife to a lake to escape the turmoil, but soon got a call saying he had to come back the next morning. Chapter 15. Gary got another subpoena, eventually getting six in all. More questioning before a video camera with a court reporter and prosecution lawyers crowded into a small interrogation room. Lots of questions, some of which he could answer and some of which he couldn't due to, quote, "privileged information," unquote. and some details he withheld because no one asked the exact question needed to get that data. Some he withheld because he felt it was just too close to the Clintons. Some data he related about affairs higher-ups in the Secret Service were involved in made trouble for his bosses. Gary asked several times during the video questioning if the video would ever be made public or if the director of the Secret Service would ever see it, and each time was reassured by FBI and Justice Department personnel that the videos would remain private, which did not happen. Gary was told by another Secret Service agent that right after the other agent had also given sworn testimony, the president made a point of coming up to him and knew his name and made small talk, and then asked how his wife and kids were. The president had never done that before to anyone and had never given any indication of even knowing the other agent's name. It was spooky, and it seemed to both of them that the president was sending a message to the other agent. No actual threat was made, but still, why would the president make a point of doing that so soon after the agent had testified? It made Gary more certain that this was indeed how the Clintons operated. Despite being told by the Secret Service attorneys that the video sessions were supposed to take the place of live courtroom testimony, Starr called them in to testify in court. The Secret Service argued that privilege applied, and Starr said it didn't. A judge agreed with Starr. The Secret Service appealed. Three judges at the Court of Appeals for D.C. agreed with the judge. The Treasury Department / Secret Service appealed to the Supreme Court. Chief Justice William Rehnquist ruled that the appeals court ruling held so Gary could testify. He and other personnel gave their testimony. On August 17, 1998, Clinton gave a videotaped testimony that also went live to the grand jury. That night he spoke on national TV to the nation in a four-minute address. After watching the presentation, Gary was upset because the president never apologized to the Secret Service personnel involved in protecting him and covering up for him, and never apologized for all the wasted time spent by so many people involved in the investigation. The implication was that all the trouble was caused by others, the media, the Republicans, anyone but the Clintons. A month or two later, the video sessions Gary and others had made with the Starr people were made public. The Treasury Department people explained that technically they hadn't lied when they said they wouldn't make the tapes public. They never technically lie. Because they had turned the tapes over to Congress, and Congress had released the tapes. The president's grand jury testimony was also released, and people got to watch in excruciatingly detailed fashion, strung out over hours, how the president attempted to weasel over and around the various questions. Pretty eye-opening and revealing of the president's true character. Comment from the summarizer CleanGov is, not the kind of person one would want in the highest office of the land, actually. Well worth the price of the book just for this one segment with several pages of extensive quotes from the president's testimony. End of comment from CleanGov. Continuing with the summary, one interesting fact among many was that the president found out that Monica's name was on the witness list for the Paula Jones legal case on December 6, 1997, which was the very day he was in the Oval Office screwing Eleanor Mondale, which Gary hadn't known who it was at the time. And that was when Monica showed up at the Northwest Gate. Comment from the summarizer, CleanGov. I mean, why would the president continue with such behavior under those circumstances especially? It showed to me that he really felt he was above the law and above any mundane questions of right and wrong. End of comment from the summarizer, CleanGov. Continuing with the survey, the summary. Gary felt that the Clintons blamed everyone else for their troubles except themselves. The president was impeached, and in the end, the Senate acquitted him. Chapter 16. Not much about the Clintons in this chapter. It covers the period when he was working at the Secret Service Training Center as a firearms instructor, the destruction of the World Trade Center buildings on 9/11, about helping show visiting dignitaries around Washington, and ultimately, his decision to leave the Secret Service and join the recently expanded Federal Air Marshal Service. He left the Secret Service on January 12, 2003. At one point, he said, about 75% of all air marshals were former Secret Service who had been disillusioned or disrespected or both in the Secret Service. Comment from the summarizer CleanGov. Remember recent news reports about Secret Service agents visiting brothels while in foreign countries. They still have a morale problem and probably have internal discrepancies that need sorting out. End of comment from the summarizer CleanGov. Continuing with the summary. Chapter 17. Nothing on the Clintons, really, but a lot about things in the Air Marshal Service that need improving. Really illustrative of probably how a lot of government programs and operations work, with wrong priorities and policies being set by ignorant executives who were placed in positions of authority with no real training or qualifications for the job. All fixable, really, but it would take the right people in charge, putting other good people in charge of various areas below them. We don't seem to have that. Chapter 18. This chapter is an interesting tale about Gary's involvement in special flights to Cyprus in 2006 to bring Americans back to the U.S. after things got pretty hot over there. Very difficult trips. The afterword. Byrne talks about Hillary and her emails at length, about how nobody transmits classified material on the internet. Nobody except Hillary. He talks about the Clinton Foundation, which has accepted many millions of dollars from foreign countries or foreign nationals, and which same countries or individuals just happen to be the beneficiaries of favorable U.S. government decisions or regulations around the same time as the donations were made. He talks about Benghazi and what happened there. He says that Hillary lied about the reasons for the Benghazi attack and lied about it to the nation and to the families of the people who died there. She's a liar. That's the end of the summary of the book, and what follows are comments from the summarizer, CleanGov. Comments. The reason he wrote the book, in addition to getting a lot of things off his chest that needed to be brought out in the open, was to convince a lot of people that Hillary Clinton should under no circumstances be president of the United States. Most of the specific derogatory data is about her husband, Bill Clinton, and it's pretty damning in my view. But see the end comments below. The data about Hillary is more general and more about the personal traits he observed in her that he feels makes her unfit to lead the country. I have to agree with his assessment of her. As I look at various media outlets on the internet, I watch very little TV, it seems to me that Clinton gets a few negative stories here and there, but nothing like the attacks and innuendo and bad rumors leveled at Trump. I personally feel it is quite likely that the media ownership is aware of the megabucks, the huge megabucks the Clintons have amassed in their Clinton Foundation, and feel that a large number of very wealthy individuals in many foreign countries have invested billions in the foundation in return for expected agendas that Hillary will push if elected, and they are doing everything they can to safeguard that investment. I have no proof of that at all, but it makes sense to me as a working hypothesis. It's all about the money to be spent on programs that will push the U.S. population and probably huge numbers of people in other lands further into the mud while the rich get richer and more in control. The book is also illustrative of conditions and policies in the Secret Service and in the Federal Air Marshal Service, and one can get the idea that it's probably like that in most parts of the U.S. government. A stated purpose or reason for existence that sounds good or actually is a good purpose, and which is then short-circuited by poor internal policies and programs that result in poor levels of professionalism and poor levels of production or service toward the stated mission of the department. I would think things like what was described in the book could be solved and improved upon by executives of goodwill fairly straightforwardly if they had the vision to see and the willingness to look and the will to act. He spoke hopefully about a recently hired head of the Secret Service in 2014. Gary Byrne spoke favorably. But judging only from at least two separate incidents reported in the media about Secret Service agents engaging in pretty bad behavior while off duty in foreign countries, I think it likely that the Secret Service still has some basic morale and ethics problems. And those morale and ethics issues may result from having to deal with the same kinds of things that Gary described in this book. All in all, I think this is a very good book, and it took some courage to write it. I think it's well worth buying the book, if only for those pages where Clinton is giving his deposition on camera. On second thought, I think all presidents should be womanizers, chasing after anything in skirts. If one looks at Clinton's record, one sees that he steadily reduced the size of the federal budget deficit until it actually had a surplus in the last 3 years or so of his administration. We haven't seen that since. One also sees that while he had some thorny international problems to deal with, and the U.S. was involved in several conflicts and peacekeeping actions around the world, it was nothing like the never-ending wars we have been subjected to since then. So from this, I can only conclude that Clinton must have been so preoccupied with sex and the various scandals that dogged his time in public office that he didn't have much time left for the traditional activities of a president, which is figuring out how to spend money we don't have and which country to send troops to next. We need more like him. Please note that this last paragraph is tongue-in-cheek. Please don't quote me seriously. But still, it's something worth thinking about. End of comments by CleanGov. Copyright 2016 by Fastbooks. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much.